Hey everyone, and welcome to this special Risky Business feature podcast. My name's Patrick Gray. This podcast is brought to you by the Hewlett Foundation. The foundation awarded us a grant a little while ago so that we could prepare feature podcasts about cyber policy issues. And this is the third podcast in that series, which is a four podcast series. Previously, we heard from the R Street Institute's Jim Baker on the topic of encryption. Of course, Mr. Baker was previously the general counsel at the FBI. And then we heard from former Pentagon official Kate Charlotte on defending forward. But in this podcast, we're going to hear from two different people on the same topic. And the topic today is industrial control system security. It feels like ICS security concerns are reaching fever pitch right now. We're seeing regular headlines about all sorts of state-backed attackers implanting malware on each other's critical ICS networks. So I thought this seemed like the type of topic that we should explore in a policy-focused series. Now, there's the military and intelligence thinking around this, and then there's the technical and defender policy thinking around this, and those two are two very different things. So in this podcast, we're going to hear from two different interview subjects. A bit later on, we'll be hearing from Rob Lee, the founder of Dragos, a company that focuses exclusively on ICS security. But before we chat with Rob, we'll be hearing from Eric Rosenbach. Eric is the co-director of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School. He also heads the Defending Digital Democracy Project there. And Eric has a very long and fascinating resume. As Assistant Secretary of Defense, he led the U.S. Defense Department's efforts to counter cyber attacks by Iran and North Korea on U.S. critical infrastructure, which seems kind of relevant to the topic at hand. He's also worked as a Chief Security Officer in the private sector and served as the Pentagon Chief of Staff from 2015 to 2017. Eric joined me for this conversation, and I started off by asking him if the pace of attacks against US critical infrastructure has increased as much as news reports would have us believe. And here's what he said.
Here's the way I think about it. When I first started in the Pentagon as an Obama administration senior political appointee, which was about 9 years ago now, it was very rare when you would see nation state malware in the grid, in the US grid, in other people's grids. Now, by the time I left the Obama administration, it was shockingly normal for people in the electric power sector to know that Cozy Bear was in the grid, or sometimes Chinese malware was in the grid. So it's really unfortunate because it's something that's publicly known and unfortunately kind of publicly accepted. And that's a bad thing.
It's amazing what you get used to, isn't it? Right? Because
when people get used to it, then there's inaction and there's a complacency that is not helpful from a national security perspective, and it impacts the whole policymaking process in a lot of ways.
We have read, and I'm not sure if these reports have been confirmed, but we have read that perhaps the United States is starting to do similar things to the people who are doing that to it. I don't know if that's something that that you know anything about.
I don't know anything for certain, and if it's happening as classified, but I can talk a little bit about the decision-making process that would go behind that. So for example, during the Obama administration, we had made the conscious decision to very rarely do the type of advanced reconnaissance, cyber reconnaissance. Some people call it the preparation of the battlefield or the preparation of the environment, so to speak, that was necessary to map those industrial control systems and the grid, the things you could use to take down the grid if you wanted to do that. Normally, that would only be part of advanced military planning for a probable contingency. So think about some of the planning that may have gone into a possible military strike on Iran.
Would only do the preparation if you were actually planning on doing something with it as part of a broader military campaign.
Exactly right. And the reason that you would do that is because you feared the escalation cycle that could occur if you did it in a country where you weren't seriously considering military action, right? So for example, the thought that we would put malware in the Russian grid before things were very tense was not on the table. And the reason was very clear. When the Russians find that, people always find this stuff. They would think, what is it that the Americans are planning? It makes them even more emboldened to go back, put more stuff in our grid. And you start to get in this destabilizing cycle, you know, where things could escalate much more quickly than you want.
Well, it feels like that's where we are now, right? And this is why, you know, just earlier I mentioned that it was previously unthinkable, and you just outlined exactly why it was unthinkable. What changed to make this normal? Because I can't quite put my finger on it.
Here's what's changed. I attribute this to the Russians. I think this is fair. I don't think this is just me being a chest thumping, you know, former American defense guy. But the Russians were the first country to attack civilian infrastructure in the form of the Ukrainian grid. And they did it twice. They continue to use Ukraine and other places as their own kind of private cyber range for testing these things. As I mentioned before, it's very well known that they have some of the preparatory malware you use to do surveillance of grids in the United States, in the U.S. grid. And so when the Russians are that aggressive, and on top of the fact of them being aggressive, they don't respect international law and the type of professional military things that go into planning an operation like that, in particular, thinking about collateral damage, it's made other countries more willing to do it. And I think also has made the U.S. think more aggressively about doing some of those things itself.
So essentially it just took one to give license to others to do the same.
Well, because, you know, you need to think about this from a balance of power perspective. If the Russians have malware in our grid, and we know that they do, and it's a widely known fact, even in unclassed warnings, but the U.S. doesn't have a reciprocal type of edge, that type of leverage, then you're at a strategic disadvantage.
Well, I can't help but think of the Dr. Strangelove mineshaft gap line there.
Right,
yeah, we cannot allow a grid malware gap. But yes, look, it absolutely makes a lot of sense. Now, just before we move on to the topic of what can be done about this from a policy perspective, you know, you did just mention international law that, you know, there are international law considerations here when you're looking at things like, you know, the preferred euphemism of the West is collateral damage. But I do wonder what the legal implications would be of doing this type of preparation. Just even if there's no plan to further escalate it, you know, once you start fiddling around with civilian infrastructure in other countries that you're not at war with, I mean, I would assume that is legally problematic. Am I wrong?
It's very legally problematic. So on one thing, just to clarify collateral damage, there could clearly be collateral damage that were actual human lives. And that, you know, would be the worst case. But I'm thinking more along the lines of the Russian use of malware or ransomware, in which they don't do the type of planning you need to control the cyber munition, to control it only on the targeted network for which it was intended to strike. And think about NotPetya as a perfect example.
Yeah.
It then spreads throughout the world. The collateral damage is Maersk to the tune of 3.5 weeks of operational downtime. What, I think they're up to $900 million in declared costs now. That's collateral damage too. The intended target was an organic financial firm in the Ukraine, not Maersk, not Merck, not the UK health system. That's definitely collateral damage. So in that case,
that is a fair point. That is absolutely
right.
Fair
right. Point. Yeah. So it's just your point is exactly that's the most extreme thing we should have to watch out for. But there are systemic things that are important too. I'll give you another example. The United States government used to, the Department of Defense, Department of State, negotiate with the Russians about a set of international norms in which we had stated and they agreed that there would be no attack on civilian critical infrastructure, not during a time of war. At the same time that we were negotiating this and that the Russians were pushing very hard for that, they're planting malware in our electric grid. They're attacking what I would consider the critical infrastructure of our election systems. And so, you know, there are some countries that respect the rule of law. There are others that don't. The Russians, from my experience, are the country that most often uses international law to advance their national interests in a way that we would call lawfare. They would use law to their advantage to tie the hands of liberal democracies like Australia, like the United States, like the French, but not abide by the same rules. They try to tie you up so that you're more hesitant. You're not able to do the operational things that you might otherwise do, but that they don't respect it, right? So it's very disingenuous. And unfortunately, it undermines international law too for people who respect it. If they see the Russians are just taking advantage of it, it makes you take it less seriously.
I guess I'm asking specifically in the case of ICS, you know, civilian infrastructure. You know, is there a legal case that you can even make to go and start fiddling with civilian infrastructure? Is that possible or is it just completely forbidden?
No, the legal case would be that you have to see there's some type of imminent threat to national security. So, for
example, it has to be ongoing and the usual checklist, right?
Ongoing, yeah, just like in any other military domain. So, you know, for people who are familiar with that policy space, it really isn't any different in the calculus that you do. Now, the place where there is more gray space is if you say, well, we're not planning an attack. We're only conducting intelligence collection on these critical infrastructure networks, right? But the problem is when discovered by an adversary and they see you're only conducting intelligence, as you and all your listeners know, it's really hard to figure out whether this is just doing surveillance or whether this is the surveillance you're doing to implant, you know, the more destructive part of the malware. And that's when things can spin out of control too.
Yes. Okay. Now, so this brings up the next topic, which is there's two things that I want to cover when it comes to policy response, right? There's first of all, you've got the you know, how on earth do we de-escalate this? That's one very big part of the policy debate on this or the policy discussion on this. And then the other part is like, what can government do to try to assist the operators of critical infrastructure to secure that infrastructure? So let's start with the de-escalation. It feels like we are in a very sensitive situation right now. Everybody's got shells everywhere and it feels like we're a hop, skip and a jump away from attacks. I mean, you know, as you pointed out, there were attacks against Ukrainian interests, which according to recent reporting look like they were intended to be quite damaging. So, you know, something like that happening against the networks of a major power could really tip things one way. I mean, it feels like we are very close to things spiraling, right? So let's start with de-escalation. How on earth do we de-escalate this?
I think an important part of de-escalation is communicating very clearly to the nation states that are playing around with this stuff that an attack on critical infrastructure, an ICS or a grid, would be the equivalent of a physical attack. And that if you do that, there will be a proportional response. So, you know, unfortunately, sometimes in the Obama administration, we weren't very clear about that. And when you send mixed messages to adversary states about what your response will be to some of the most serious types of cyber attacks, they can become emboldened. At the same time, I think the U.S. needs to be pretty cautious about not getting too far out there. But I have to be honest, you know, I read a lot of this stuff about Cybercom having more forward defense or defending forward. I don't think they're really doing anything differently than we did during the Obama administration.
They're just communicating it clearly.
Yeah, they communicate it more clearly. It's a different academic bumper sticker. You know, they're doing some intelligence collection that would allow them to take an offensive action. They're not doing offensive action. In the case of Iran, that they are conducting more offensive operations, but that's a different target set. Those are military targets. So to bring it back, you'll de-escalate most clearly by being very clear about what your response would be. That makes an adversary much less likely to go there to the point that they would launch the big attack.
But that only works in certain circumstances, doesn't it? I mean, in the case of the United States and Russia playing brinkmanship, that might work. But when you're dealing with, say, Russia against Ukraine, you know, Ukraine's not going to threaten Russia over something like that because they are at a severe power disadvantage. When you look at the pariah states like North Korea, if they start interfering with the infrastructure of large countries, there's not really much anyone can do about that because they are a nuclear armed fortress. So it does feel like, you know, threats might not really do much to de-escalate this beyond certain specific instances of this sort of thing happening.
Oh, you're exactly right. In the class I teach here at the Kennedy School, when we're talking about this, I flash a picture of North Korea at night, in which you see the only lights in the entire part of the peninsula are just around Pyongyang. And it makes you realize, first of all, there are very few options for a retaliatory cyber strike. And second of all, if they were to try to take down the U.S. grid or U.S. election systems, you would have to escalate so quickly that it would go to real military action, which has big repercussions for Seoul and the 21,000 artillery tubes that the North Koreans have right across the demilitarized zone. So it's those pariah states, just like you mentioned, that are the hardest cases. And you need to, again, though, communicate very clearly that if they would do something that would result in the deaths of Americans, they need to know that there would be so-called cross-domain deterrence, where the U.S. would take military action that could involve the loss of lives of North Koreans. You don't want to go there, but Kim Jong-un, he needs to know that you're firm in a decision like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's just that then we're talking about a whole other type of escalation, though. That's my concern, yeah. Right? Is if you say, it's okay, scary. You mess with our grid, we're gonna bomb you. I mean, if bombs start dropping on North Korea, things could get pretty nasty pretty quickly, and it affects the calculus, right?
Yeah, that's why this is also scary, and you hope that in communicating that clearly, probably publicly in some ways, but privately, that you discourage the North Koreans from going too far. I think they also are rational enough that they don't want it to escalate to that point. But if there were ever the geopolitical environment where things really started to ratchet up, the United States and a lot of other democracies are at a huge disadvantage when it comes to trying to respond to, you know, this high-end type of cyber attack against the grid and against industrial control systems. We're on the losing end. We live mostly in a glass house.
So I'm going to put here on the form where it says de-escalation, ? No clear path. Because it doesn't really feel like there is one right now.
Yeah, it's unclear. The path, if anything, is not very good. You do not have a lot of very good options, that's for sure.
So look, this brings us to the next part of this, which is, you know, ICS security policy, right? Now, governments often, I remember something like, geez, 15 years ago, the Australian government launched a program where it would pay for, I think, 50% of the cost of penetration tests against networks if they were deemed to be critical infrastructure. I believe the take-up on that wasn't really that good because the paperwork was just so onerous that a lot of people just didn't even bother. But, you know, you can't really pen test your way to security as we know these days. I guess one of the reasons I want to talk about the policy policy approaches to securing national infrastructure, national ICS infrastructure. One of the reasons I want to talk about that is it seems to me that, you know, the extent to which securing this stuff is a problem is probably not really well understood by policymakers. Do you think that that's a fair statement?
I think it's absolutely a fair statement, yeah.
Yeah, because, it's not like, defending a traditional network is difficult enough, but it feels like control systems are sort of insecure by design, right? Like there's no real way to make a control system acceptably resistant to attack. Do you agree with that?
No, I agree. Yeah, there are all the things that your listeners know about. You're going to try to air gap the SCADA control network from the administrative networks. Everyone knows, though, that humans are lazy and fallible and there end up being connections, and that even if there were an air gap network, these high-end adversaries find ways to jump it either via some type of Bluetooth or human exploit, and that there will be vulnerabilities.
If it's a large enough network, they can have someone on the ground just plug into it because some of these networks hundreds of miles.
Yeah, right? A lot of times where even not super advanced nation states, the Iranians, for example, have been using human, to get malware employed in a lot of different places in Saudi. So exactly right.
It feels to me that the best thing you're going to be able to do is to make the networks resistant to the most malicious actions. So, design them knowing that they can't really trust themselves and try to limit the serious harm that an attacker could actually do with that. And furthermore, the second prong of your defense approach there might be to focus on detection so that you know when you do have an adversary going after you. Is that the sort of two things that pop up in your discussions around this?
I think that's all right. I think that's good. I think one of the most important things, though, that the government could do is incentivize some of these big infrastructure providers to invest more in cyber defense. So you all know, everyone on this podcast knows that security is a cost center. And if you don't give some type of government incentive to critical infrastructure providers to invest more in security and defense, in most cases, they can't do it. And because in the US, we have no regulatory stick or very few to enforce that, I think it's on the incentive side. There is a role for the government in doing detection of these type of advanced threats. And so when I was in the government, we ran a couple pilot programs where using classified signatures from NSA, we would work with internet service providers to essentially, you know, look at inbound traffic and see if there were any advanced threats. It was all done with very close scrutiny by lawyers and civil liberties experts to make sure that there was nothing, you know, nefarious going on. But I think it's those type of creative solutions that we need to look to more to try to find some nexus of government cooperation with the private sector and service providers to protect the country. A place like Israel has been able to do that very effectively and creatively and still within the law. One other thing that I have seen when I was in the government is that there was use of the National Guard, again, under the control of the state attorney general and with a lot of scrutiny of civil liberties experts and privacy experts, to see if the National Guard, with some of the new cyber capabilities they have, could look at critical infrastructure threats in a way that the private sector would not be able to.
So where does this leave us? Where do we begin?
I think, you know, this is a wholly unsatisfying answer, but when it comes down to it, it's just your holistic risk mitigation, where you think it's a combination of high-end deterrence and hoping that you can convince bad guys and adversaries that if they conduct an attack, that the cost of doing that is going to be very painful to them. Knowing that, just like you said, that there are nation states for which that will not be effective, primarily the North Koreans, but there could be others, combined with you try to get some government incentives to improve the overall level of defense for some of the critical infrastructure operators and service providers. And then, just like we did in the Obama administration, you have an incident response plan where you think like, okay, if part of the grid goes down, part of our deterrence is going to be through resilience, that we know how to bring it back up and that the overall impact will be mitigated by our ability to absorb the blow and bounce back. And there's something to that too, but you have to be able to rehearse that. There was a year in the Obama administration where we set aside 2 weeks for a national level exercise just to rehearse what the country would do with private critical infrastructure providers in the event of a major attack on the grid. You know, that's definitely not a panacea, but that's something just like you do at the firm enterprise level that you have to rehearse, you have to practice, and think about that in conjunction with what, you know, some of your military and diplomatic responses would be.
So the only thing we can do here is to prepare for the worst, hope for the best, use a bit of military flex to scare people into not doing it, and in the meantime, set some baseline standards that most critical infrastructure operators will probably ignore.
Unfortunately, that's a good summary of the situation. Yeah, it probably doesn't leave people sleeping well at night, does it?
No, it doesn't. Now, look, just while I've got you and very quickly, before we started recording this interview, you know, we were talking about that situation in Johannesburg where people were unable to buy electricity credits because the systems that enable that had been ransomwared. So, I mean, that's just such a crazy 2019 thing to say. We all talk about this threat of you know, specialist ICS malware, Trisus, Triton, all of that sort of stuff. We're sort of obsessed with that insecurity. But, you know, the next major disruption may well be caused by some bit of crappy ransomware that some operator manages to squeeze into a utility. Do you think that is a risk, that is a probable risk there?
I think that the spread of ransomware is actually a bigger risk than an attack on an industrial control system. And it doesn't have to be just from some 400-pound guy on a couch. the North Koreans right now are using ransomware in a very effective and widespread manner because they've seen that they can use it to raise cryptocurrency to get around sanctions. They can use it strategically to cripple some of their adversaries. So I think the threat of ransomware on non-industrial control system networks is actually a bigger risk than high-end malware trying to go after ICS.
Do you think that it rises to the level of being a national security threat?
Yes, because you have national intel agencies like the GRU and the North Korean Cyber Army using it, and then others who are lower-end actors using some of the same stuff, you know, to attack small municipal governments, to attack cities. We've seen it quite often in the U.S., and that's something where the government has a role in defending against.
And how should they defend with that? Do you think that they should engage intelligence and military agencies to try to combat this? And I'm not just talking about the state actors there. Yeah. I'm talking about the criminal actors as well.
I think so. If it raises to the point that there are criminal actors that are shutting down city and local governments with ransomware, there's a government responsibility to stop that. You can't just stand by and watch, you know, states get locked up, cities get locked up. There is a role there.
It's funny, actually, because Adam and I had a discussion with a Der Spiegel journalist about this quite recently, and Adam's line that I will not soon forget, it was a good one. He says, I don't like the idea of military and intelligence agencies being used to do stuff that was traditionally law enforcement, but I also like my hospitals to work. And I think that's right. Where he where he came down on that. Eric Rosenbach, thank you so much for joining us on Risky Business to have this discussion. It's been very, very interesting, and I hope we can do it again one day. Much appreciated.
Thank you so much for the invite. Good luck with everything you're doing. It's really important.
That was Eric Rosenbach there sharing his thoughts with us on ICS security. Okay, next up, we're going to chat with Rob Lee. Robert M. Lee is the founder of Dragos Inc., a very well-known and respected company that focuses purely on ICS and OT security. Rob started out in InfoSec with the US Air Force as a cyber warfare operations officer tasked to the NSA. But as you'll hear, Rob is actually pretty optimistic about the ICS and OT security challenge. In this interview, you'll hear his perspective on the policy challenge, as well as some details about how Dragos is trying to offer commercial services that will have an impact here. And I would like to state categorically that I have absolutely no commercial arrangement or involvement with Dragos. I encourage Rob to talk about what they're doing there, because it's legitimately interesting and creative. So I started off by asking Rob to help us define what the ICS and OT security challenge actually is. And here's what he said.
Yeah, I would say that the fundamental ways we've approached enterprise security don't necessarily overlie with the risk we're trying to reduce in industrial. And the technical controls that we usually implement may not matter at all. I usually point to like patching as an example. You know, my analyst looked at the vulnerabilities that come out in industrial control systems. And if I were to tell anybody, don't patch a system, it would sound absurd. But we looked and found that something like 64% of all the industrial vulnerabilities were next to meaningless, if not completely meaningless. So ultimately, the way that we're approaching this problem is not only different, but you've got to realize that there's that whole physics side of the challenge. And when we're trying to secure these environments, we have to make sure that we're doing it in a safe and reliable manner as well.
I'd imagine too, look, a couple of things to talk about there. One is that the idea of sort of securing an ICS environment, a lot of people don't realize that you can't really secure it in the same way. I mean, I guess that's what you were talking about, but I think it's helpful to point out that a lot of these protocols and whatnot are sort of insecure by design, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, that term's definitely been used in the industry a lot, and I think it's fair. And I would even point out that even when you do create more securable products, that the problem is still that we have to have functionality in those environments that adversaries can take advantage of. When we look at like the Ukraine attacks as an example, all of the adversary was really doing is using native functionality to open up circuit breakers in the same way that an operator could. And I think it's useful to start reducing the information attack space and reducing some of the functionality in those environments that we know we don't need. But there's always going to be functionality. that people have to interact with the physical systems and environment around them, and adversaries can always take advantage of that.
So I guess a big part of this is going to come down to engineering your ICS environments so that if an attacker does actually gain access to them, they're limited in how much damage they can cause.
I think that's a definitely a component of it. I think there's kind of an intel-driven approach to the world, which is what are the threats doing and let's monitor for that and be able to respond to it. And I think there's the consequence-driven approach to the world, which is what could go wrong in these environments that we don't want to deal with. And that's the engineering piece. So we see Department of Energy doing things like consequence-driven cyber-informed engineering, or CCE, which is exactly that. It's basically saying, does the digital relay on my power grid really need to be able to run Minesweeper? I mean, that's basically the concept of, can we reduce some of the functionality here? And there's also the, hey, no matter what we reduce out, the adversary is always going to be able to do some things. Can we monitor for those and be able to be reactive and proactive enough when they occur? Because a major component of what we deal with is getting proper root cause analysis. It's not just seeing that an attack occurred. It's that if a plant trips or a relay trips or a circuit breaker is opened, that the operators and the security folks have the context required in what they're going to do. Because you could do more damage than the attacker themselves if you just treat it like a maintenance event when it's actually a cyber attack.
So, I mean, that sort of begs the question. I'd imagine that the most difficult thing to prevent would be an attacker being able to somehow shut something down by doing funny stuff, right? I mean, I get that you're saying that we have a shot at stopping attackers from being able to do damaging things, but would you agree that preventing an attacker from being able to essentially DOS an ICS environment is going to be the challenge?
Yeah, it's a challenge, and I think it's a good one. So I think that it takes a lot of expertise to know what you're going to do in a reliable manner in industrial environments. So like years ago, Mike Asante and I wrote this paper titled The ICS Cyber Kill Chain, and we basically said if you're looking at phase two or stage two of an industrial attack, there's a lot of knowledge that goes into the engineering and the systems and kind of the physics of the problem to really create a high confidence, reliable attack by an adversary. But if you're just wanting to like trip a system, sure, go in and like in-map the environment, you're going to trip a system, but it's going to be a nuisance. It's not going to be a really good attack. To really be able to DOS the system in a way that is having an effect that's more long-term, whether it's physical damage or even just a reliable outage, that takes a lot more skill, and those are the kind of things that we can get ahead of.
Yeah. Well, that's some nice news there. Now, look, this is great, right? Because what you're talking about are the best approaches to securing ICS environments. But I know other people who work in ICS environments, and they don't exactly report positive things when they come back from these gigs, right? There are certainly some organizations who are trying to do the right thing here, but they appear to be overwhelmingly in the minority. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would say yes. I would say that we are just beginning on this journey. I often tell people that the threat is worse than we realize, but not as bad as we want to imagine. And what I mean by that is if we know that like visibility into your industrial environments is the first step, and then you get into detection response and so forth, I think it's fair to say a minority of the community really has that visibility today, like maybe 5%. But what's really exciting is we didn't have any of this kind of movement 5-6 years ago in a reliable way as an industry or community, and we're seeing a whole shift. So I think some people, when they first come into this community, they go, oh my God, we're so behind. Regulations has got to be the answer. We got to do something different than defense because we're so screwed. And the reality is companies are moving quickly and making significant strides, and it's extremely positive. And if you're measuring vulnerability rates in a power plant, then yeah, sure, we're all screwed because those suck. But when you realize that those aren't actually the biggest impactful things, and most of the times they're not important anyways, and you realize how seriously the industrial community is taking this, you get really optimistic very quickly.
Well, that's nice. Look, check him out. He's Rob Glass Half Full Lee. Fantastic to have someone on the show actually saying happy things. You know, a lot of these attackers tend to come in via the sort of traditional APT malware route, right? When we're talking about some of these state-backed actors who seem to be really enjoying getting up in each other's grids. You know, one idea that maybe is worth floating is pushing the enterprise networks of these critical infrastructure providers maybe through some high security gateways. Do you think that that is something worth exploring?
Not really. I think on a fundamental level, it sounds good. And in theory, if we had like unlimited resources and forget policy and cultural and other issues related to operations, it's interesting. But our environments are connected. They are becoming more connected. A lot of people used to think that they had air gap networks. We all know they aren't. But a lot of organizations still think that they're highly segmented and that you have to go through the enterprise to get to the industrial environments. But the reality is you don't. You're connected up through integrators, maintenance folks, vendors, your equipment, or manufacturers themselves. GE's got access to every gas turbine on the planet, and you don't have to go through your enterprise to get there. So I think industrial environments are connected to somebody's enterprise, and it's not necessarily yours. So putting too much focus on yours sort of betrays the problem. And the other challenge there is the trend of the industry is like cloud connected sensors. You know, we would essentially have to say, let's stop making a profitable industry. Let's stop making, company revenue, and let's just focus on security. And maybe this one way of doing it is useful. So I don't want to completely kill the idea, but I've heard this time and time again. Even senators have come out and said, well, let's have a electric grid network that's separated from the internet. And it's like, yeah, you couldn't run the grid that way.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I got to ask, though, does this current situation with the escalation in state-backed actors doing pretty deep recon of grids and maybe even putting some malware here and there so that they've got at least a decent first stage access? I mean, does that to you explain why government types are getting very bloody nervous at the moment?
The escalation is definitely there. Undoubtedly, we've seen more aggressive and more numerous sort of threats than we've ever seen before. But it's partly because we're also looking more than we've ever seen before. Now, they are increasing, don't get me wrong, and the level of aggressive nature against safety systems and protection systems and other, core components that we thought we maybe had more years on, it's worrying. But people are going into these environments more and they're seeing more. Like, we get called in. I mean, a lot of these cases don't get public, but we're talking like one or two major incident response cases a month that we deal with, and that's unheard of in industrial. But a lot of times it's because those companies were actually doing really proactive, good things, and it's actually almost a hallmark of maturity. But what I think happens on the government side, and this is coming from having been at the NSA and doing the ICS threat discovery mission, is you see the bad stuff, but you don't get the resolution. And so if you're working in a manufacturer, a pharmaceutical company, a power company, whatever, you get the day-to-day resolution of whether you fixed the problem or not, or if you solved it, or if it was a false positive or whatever. But if you're looking outside the environments, which is what the government does, they don't have access into your industrial networks. When they're looking outside the environment, it only looks bad, real bad and worse, with no resolution. And so the hype kind of builds, and it's not out of malice, it's just never getting the satisfaction of actually completing those cases. And I think as the attention grows, as people realize just how much industrial is, people used to think it was just utilities, but it's basically everything except for insurance and financial companies. People are freaking out just on the exposure. But I think the insight.
Well, I mean, it's not just the exposure. I mean, we have seen the same actors who have performed destructive attacks in places like Ukraine now turning their attention to US ICS networks. So I wouldn't say that, I'm going to defend people being freaked out over that.
No, let me take it another way, though. So I'm interpreting your question incorrectly, but I'm taking it from the government point of view. If you're talking about have things gotten worse over the last couple of years and it's worrying, hell yeah, it is. Like the threat that we were tracking that Detrisis against the Saudi Arabian facility, Xenotime, we saw them targeting electric companies across Australia, the United States, and in parts of Europe. That's scary as hell that a team that actually tried to kill people is now targeting critical infrastructure sites. That's absolutely worrisome. But to your point about malware implanted in systems and similar, government has come out with that narrative over the years about, well, China's already implanted our grid and, no more technical limitations and being able to turn off the lights. And that's total BS. they don't have that visibility. So this is where like operators in the US get called into classified meetings and they're told like, come to this classified meeting and we tell you these things. And there's no secret sauce behind the curtain because they don't have collection inside of industrial networks to tell you that.
So what is it that you think the role of government in all of this is?
Yeah, I think government has been a fantastic partner to the infrastructure community over the years. The role and responsibility of government, though, is largely on coordination and prioritization. The government has routinely tried to say, call us for instant response, use our new lab technology, let me give you classified intel. And all that stuff has failed time and time again. What works is a representative of the government coming into a board meeting at a, you know, Fortune 500 and saying, here's the three things the United States government's worried about and you should invest here, and they'll do it hand over fist. They'll do it without regulation. The prioritization and the added context of what we care about and why, government can do a really good job there, and coordination across sectors, because a lot of people think about information sharing as technical indicators and feeds and similar, but real information sharing is knowledge sharing between a CSO to another CSO or a SOC to another SOC. And government can and has facilitated that. InfraGuard, the FBI has done a fantastic job with InfraGuard over the years in local communities of bringing together players and just having them talk.
It's interesting what you said, though, about the idea of, you know, some elected representative actually, you know, raising awareness on this stuff, because what you're talking about there is essentially political leadership on cybersecurity, which we haven't really seen from anywhere, have we?
I haven't seen. I mean, there's a couple, right? Congressman Langevin, Congressman Rubersberger, Congressman Hurd. There's been a couple in the House that have really brought attention to the issue, even showing up at places like DEF CON and similar. But you're right. There's been a gap, a real gap. What I've been excited about, though, is the topic of industrial security. Because when I testified to the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, and even in this hotly contested environment that we have today, I saw Republicans and Democrats agreeing, getting along, and discussing how to advance topics of cybersecurity on infrastructure. One of the problems for them is this is a newer field. I mean, it's been around for a while, but like newer in terms of expertise on threats. And every week they get some other person standing in front of them promising an answer, or government telling them, oh, only if they get clearances out to people or whatever. And it's very difficult for a senator or congressman to discern real expertise.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a problem in security generally, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, that's hard. I think the narrative sometimes is, well, these companies don't want to do it. And the reality is they just get so many conflicting narratives that every other consultant that comes in front of the board has a different view of what needs to be done. And it's analysis paralysis.
But I mean, if these same people, in government, these politicians having a little bit of a difficult time getting their head around these issues, it's going to be difficult for them to then know how to lead there, isn't it?
Correct. Yeah. I think there's very few things that they're able to action that they want to action, but there are some meaningful ones. There was funding for research sites at CCNE, so that consequence-driven cyber-informed engineering stuff we talked about. You know, the Congress passed through a bill specifically to fund a couple power companies to go try that out. Hey, DOE, you said this works. A couple industry experts say it's good. Cool. Let's put some resources towards it. There's been the same on programs to go help security at like cooperatives and munis. If you think of the larger power companies as an example, I have full confidence that a Southern company or Xcel or whoever, they're going to do a really good job in security. But your small cooperative or municipality at the small town in the United States, they're going to have a real challenge. And getting federal help, especially on resourcing, can be meaningful there.
Well, I mean, that's something that we've got to remember, right, is a lot of this ICS stuff, it's not just big companies that actually have the freedom to allocate capital to solve real problems, right? Often it is municipalities. In fact, as you would know, for a long time, everybody's go-to example of an ICS attack affected the Maroochy Shire Council in Queensland.
Yep.
It was just amazing that and it was so frequently incorrectly cited as being like, hackers and whatever. It was really a disgruntled ex-employee who used a bit of custom radio gear to open up a valve, essentially, and flood local creeks in Queensland with sewage. He was caught. I believe he went to jail. I can't really remember. But yeah, I mean, how do you solve that problem? Because obviously it's not ideal when attackers. And in that case, it wasn't actually an external attacker, but it could have been, right? How do you begin to chip away at that problem when you've got all of these sort of cash-strapped agencies operating this stuff?
Yeah, that's where we actually see role and responsibility of government and being supportive, not with yet another assessment, but actual resources towards things that we know to work. And I think we're starting to see an appetite in Congress for that. I spend an ungodly amount of time on the Hill these days talking to staffers, and there is a real appetite to help change that problem.
Yeah. I mean, the cynic in me says, Rob, and I know that you're speaking from a position of sincere belief, but it feels like you're saying your solution is like, subsidize us, a little bit.
I don't believe in that either. So that's fair. I mean, obviously, I don't want to get into like the straight up like Dragos is here to save the day crap. But I think there is a growing vendor community at the same time that there's growing expertise, at the same time that there's awareness. And so there's a market that's building. And I'm a diehard capitalist on let's find a profitable way to grow this and build this. And I just see the community coming to a head on this. I don't think there's a better time to have ever addressed this problem than now. And I see a lot of the right things to get it done. So, no, I'm not advocating subsidize, for everything. But do we have a major water site that is having a lot of trouble? Then let's look at, what critical infrastructure is really defined as versus every single possible site and refocus resources instead of here's your free briefing, free assessment, and yet another pitch from a lab.
But what does that look like? Is that sending in NSA people or ASD people in the Australian context to do it? Or is it actually a subsidy program? I mean, we're talking policy here.
Yeah, I think there is a level of investment that can be made. So as an example, one thing I've pitched to the Senate is essentially workforce development. If you hire an analyst or if you hire a network security person, the United States government taxpayer, Australian taxpayer, should not pay for Cisco networking gear and Cisco training because that company is taking advantage of that for its own profitability. But incident response skills of how to respond properly to an attack by a foreign state, that doesn't really feel like that company's role and responsibility. And expecting the government to have people to be called in and help, I think that's silly. But maybe tax credits for training and workforce development and things like workforce
incentives, incentives, not subsidies, right? I get that. But I look correct. At my local yep. government. I look at my local government and I can tell you straight up, they don't have a network security person. They are not going to have that person, right? So like, how could, for example, the Ballina Shire Council of New South Wales, how on earth are they going to chip away at this problem? They probably don't even know this is a problem, right?
Oh, man. So I'll tell you about my idea. You can feel free to cut another program because it's going straight down the Dragos lane. But we have something already rolling out in the U.S. electric cooperatives for this called Neighborhood Keeper. And it was the idea of taking the exact same technology and things that we do for big companies, but basically giving it away at cost to Conexus Cooperative and McKinsey Cooperative and these small, tiny infrastructure players. And what the deal was that the anonymous insights, so none of their actual data, but the anonymous insights come back to a central location for analysts, and DOE sponsored it in the United States, Electric ISAC works with us, et cetera, Idaho National Labs, to be able to say, you know what, we don't know who Utility One is, but Utility One's got some really bad stuff in their OT networks. And it pushes to them, hey, you don't even have a security person, but you should probably call for help. And they have a list then of their neighborhood keepers, which is the other power companies or manufacturing companies, et cetera, that have signed up to go be like a fire brigade to help them. And they also have numbers of the government and otherwise if they do want to go that direction, although I usually push them to their power companies. So a good example of this is Xcel Power Company, one of the larger power companies in the United States, acts as a neighborhood keeper to their local cooperatives and munis. And the local co-ops and munis, if they ever need help, they can call on their neighbor to do that. And I think that's a scalable model that works. And I think influence and investment from government allow the community to take care of the community.
Well, I mean, that's obviously going to stay in, right? Because that sounds like an eminently sensible sort of private-public cooperative idea that could actually have some impact. I mean, how has that program scaled up substantially? Are you getting good take-up?
Yeah, so we were supposed to do 3 entities in 2 years. We're up to about 30 now in the first 8 months. And the United States Senate has already said, this is amazing. Let's figure out how to scale this. And so we've had an amazing response. I went and briefed 65 CEOs of the largest power companies in the United States on it and had pretty good traction, where I honestly think this is something that'll work. And we're already including water and gas and smaller sites that otherwise would never have access to these things. I don't think the attack that's going to change things is going to be, you know, the East Coast going down in the United States or all of Sydney going down. I think the attack that changes things is a 30-minute small distribution level like attack. And what happens is it scares the hell out of the layman and makes them think that everything could go down and Congress will have to overreact. And I think that pushes inappropriate regulation that cripples the industry overnight. My fear is the fear, not that our infrastructure is so vulnerable that we're all going to die.
Yeah, that makes an awful lot of sense. Well, Rob Lee, it's been a real pleasure to chat to you. Fascinating discussion all around. Really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was Rob Lee there from Dragos. Big thanks to him for that, and big thanks to the Hewlett Foundation for supporting these policy podcasts. I do hope you enjoyed this episode. I'll be back next week with more security news and analysis. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.